All right, I got to say good morning again. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
There you go. Okay, so real quick on the handouts. If you were here last week, you would have just picked up some loose handouts. If you're not here, then you'll get a folder with everything last week and today in it. So the white handouts are for you to write notes on, but don't feel compelled to do that because there's some classes I go to. I just want to sit and listen. I don't want to be fooling with notes, so don't feel obligated. But they're there as an outline. If you want to use it, it may prove to be helpful. So they're all kind of like color-coded. The blue ones are sort of supplemental. The orange outline, you'll get another one next week. That will be kind of a main outline that we'll be using. And then the white ones are just what you write notes on. So all that makes sense? Don't you love it when it's color-coded?
Yes.
All right, good. Okay, so today we've got a lot of good material to get into. At least I think so. Should be interesting, should be helpful, should be even perhaps fun at times. So let's just do a real quick review. Let's talk about vocabulary some. So when we use the word church fathers, what are we... Who are we referring to? Anybody? Church fathers would be...
Pastors, elders,
maybe? They would include those folks. They would be church leaders in the early centuries of the church, okay? Just a real generic term, all right? So apostolic fathers, we'll talk more about them today. They are a particular kind of church father. Who are the apostolic fathers? I don't need the names. They are the ones who...
Of the apostles?
Yeah, they're the disciples of the disciples. They're the disciples of the apostles. They were taught directly by them. Okay? And then how we use the word Catholic and how we use the word Orthodox. We use the word Catholic with a small c to emphasize the what? Okay, the unity of the church, that's universal. We use the word Orthodox to emphasize the what of the church?
Straight doctrine.
Straight doctrine, okay, correct teaching. Okay, very good. And then we'll talk more about the bishop at some point, but what was the bishop? Today when we think of bishop, we're probably thinking of like a Roman Catholic guy in a lot of fancy garb and with a pointed hat and pomp and circumstance and all that stuff, but we have to get that image out of our mind. So when we think of bishop, what are we thinking of?
One who supervises several churches.
All right, one who supervises a number of churches in either in his city or in his region. Okay, follow all that, okay? All right, so also on the review, very important, we have three main characteristics of which the early church belonged to. Who can give me one of those? It was under...
Oh, do you mean in the Roman Empire?
Yeah, it was under the Roman Empire. It was also in a Jewish culture, and that culture was greatly influenced by
Greek
thought. Okay, so Roman, Jew, Greek. Roman Empire, Jewish culture, Greek thought. Okay. So some of the factors that contributed to the church expanding. This is important because... there were a lot of factors that contributed to its spread and evangelism quickly in the early two or three centuries. What were some of those factors?
Persecution.
Okay. We have the threat of persecution in Jerusalem, in particular, that we read about in the Book of Acts. We also have the Greek Old Testament. What do we call that? The Septuagint, the fact that the scriptures had been translated into Greek and that Greek was the common language of the day, that helped immensely in spreading the gospel. What's that?
Pax Romana.
Pax Romana. Who can tell me what Pax Romana is? Yes.
Roman peace.
Roman peace. Okay, so this would involve law and order, and it would involve political stability and stability within the borders and financial stability and that sort of thing. Okay, we have, because of the Jewish dispersion, that's different than the Christian dispersion, but before that we had the Jewish dispersion, so a few hundred years before that, due to exiles and prisoners of war and Jews moving across the region because of commerce and that sort of thing. We have now synagogues in just about every significant town, and maybe even in the little towns. And then these, as we know in the book of Acts, became staging areas or platforms by which Christians could speak from and declare the gospel from that as well. Okay, Roman currency would be another one, and there's this safe travel, all of that, and the fall of Jerusalem was very significant. Remember how we talked about that? What was significant about the fall of Jerusalem in regards to the spread of Christianity? Up to that point, Christians had been pretty much what?
Jewish.
Yeah, they've been pretty much Jewish, okay? And they've just been kind of like within the Jewish community. But because of the fall of Jerusalem, Christians did not participate in that revolt. The Jews were upset with Jewish Christians for not participating in that revolt. And then in 84 AD, they were all excommunicated from the synagogues. So now they're kind of like on their own. Up to that time, they'd been like children at home. And then they turned 18 and got kicked out, okay? That kind of thing. So That helped as well. They even got their own kind of like identity. And we'll talk more about that later. Okay, and then of course, even Greek philosophy, as strange as that may seem, contributed to the spread of Christianity because there were some elements there that were common ground. Greek philosophy talked about the difference between good and evil, talked about moral good, talked about trying to bring an understanding to the meaning of life and the problem of evil and these sorts of things. They came up to different answers than what the gospel provided, but Christians could at least piggyback on some of those concepts. All right, so that was just a quick review. Let's now these silly updates. It's not showing on that screen. No to everything. What is it? It's driving me crazy. What's it showing there? Anything? It's not showing anything? Okay. All right. So, ready for the handout now. We're ready for Josephus. How many has heard of Josephus? Probably just about everybody's heard of Josephus. So, he is a Jewish historian. We have different historians in that time period. We have Greek historians, Roman historians. He is a Jewish historian. And he's born around 37, 38, and he wrote about... primarily about Jewish history, but he included information about the early Christians, and so this is helpful for us in some regards. And he's quite wordy, but he's considered to be fairly reliable. And at the age of 19, he joined the party of the Pharisees. So we talked about their origin last week, and he was quite frankly pretty full of himself. He wrote an autobiography, and it just consists of endless boasting and bragging about how intelligent he is, and that even at 14 years old, leading scholars of Jerusalem would seek him out for his wisdom. So this is the kind of guy we're dealing with. He was also a soldier. He served as a general in one of the revolts against Rome, and had some success in those battles. However, during the revolt, which resulted in the fall of Jerusalem, he counseled his people to surrender to the Romans, and he prophesied that they would lose, and unable to persuade them, he actually went to Rome, where he worked for and became a friend to the emperor. His name was Vespasian, and Vespasian liked him because he had told the Jews that it was God's will that Rome would rule the world, and Josephus even took on Vespasian's family name, which is Flavius. So you probably have heard the name Flavius Josephus. That's where Flavius comes from, because it was Flavius Vespasian. Probably not pronouncing that name right. But okay, so as a result, he, of course, fell out of favor with his own people. And in fact, his writings have survived primarily because it was the church that preserved them. They valued them. The Jews didn't really value his writings, but the Christians did. While at Rome, he published The History of the Jewish War Against the Romans. It's a lengthy account, a volume of 20 books that starts with the history of the Jewish people all the way back from creation. And then he wrote other books that contains references to Jesus, John the Baptist, Trial James, and so on. And So on your handout there, we won't take time to read it, but he said something interesting about, it's one of your blue sheets, you're going to read it later. He said something interesting about who Jesus is, and scholars have questioned whether what has been preserved for us is actually accurate, and they have attempted to edit, redact, restore it to its original meaning. But it's kind of interesting in the claims that are made there in the writings of Josephus. All right, so moving on to other sources for early church history, we would have Eusebius. He's not until the 4th century. You may remember his name when we talk about Arianism. He was actually kind of a friend to the Emperor Constantine. And he's kind of like the first church historian that we know of. And so he's, you know, hundreds of years after this, obviously, but we would have reason to believe that he had access to information that has since been lost. And another source, of course, would be the writings of the early church fathers that have survived, or at least partially survived, and other Christian writings. We'll talk about some of those this morning. And then we have other historians of the day as well, both Greek and Roman. All right, any questions up to that point about Josephus or anything? All right, ready for the deaths of the apostles? Okay, so we'll be... I got all sorts of pop-ups here. They're driving me absolutely crazy. No, I don't want to do this.
We can't see them, so they're not driving us crazy.
That doesn't count. What counts is it drives me crazy. Okay, okay. I don't care if it drives anybody else crazy. I can't even control this thing. Is it moving? I am Google password required. I don't want to do any of that. All right, I had all this so planned. It was so going to be so spiffy. All right. So real quick, we're not going to spend any time on this one, except to say that last week we talked about the difference between the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire, the Western Church and the Eastern Church. This is more clearly defined as we get into the later part of the 4th century. But it does come up even in the early church, because we have a big debate over when Easter is to be observed. And the Latin-speaking Western Church takes odds with the Greek-speaking Eastern Church about this and becomes quite interesting and very contentious. But last week when I showed the hit, I held up the map and it wasn't very clear. So I thought this did a better job with that. All right, so let's now go to the Roman Empire of the time. This represents what the empire looked like in 117 AD. And it's going to look like this more or less for the time period that we'll be talking about. So when it comes to the deaths of the apostles and what happened to them, it's hard to know what is fact and what is legend. The information is very sketchy. We would have reason to believe that they're probably going to be fairly accurate because we don't have any great sensational, wild stories that would lend itself to skepticism. But again, we kind of have to keep this with a loose hand. So Simon Peter, there's Rome. The church tradition is that he died under Nero during that persecution. We'll be talking about that more next week. And that he was crucified. Who remembers the story? How was he crucified?
Upside down.
And he chose that because he wasn't worthy to be crucified in the same way that Jesus was. So some Protestants dispute whether Peter was actually ever in Rome. That's a whole other discussion itself, but what drives that discussion mostly has to do with Protestants challenging the Catholic tradition of Peter being the head of the church, and if they can prove that he wasn't in Rome, then that would dismantle that whole argument. That's another subject. All right, let's move on to Andrew. Andrew is crucified at Patras in Achaia, and there he's crucified for calling the Roman gods demons, and there's actually a church there in that town called St. Andrew Catholic Church. We have Philip, who's crucified at Hierapolis, which would be in modern-day Turkey. We have James, the son of Zebedee, the brother of John. He's one of the sons of thunder. Remember him wanting to call fire down upon a Samaritan town? And he was there at the transfiguration. And his death is actually recorded for us in Acts chapter 12. It was about that time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. So this would be in Jerusalem, and that's recorded for us in Acts. And then we have John, who there's kind of some confusion. In the first century, we have two Johns. We have the Apostle John, and we have John the Elder. And that even comes into the discussion on which John wrote the book of Revelation. But the prevailing thought is that it was the Apostle John who was exiled on the island of Patmos, and he was the one who died natural causes on that island. And that would be similar to kind of like the, you might think of like a modern day Alcatraz, you know, it was a prison island. All right, Bartholomew, he was, the report is that he was beaten with wood, then he was crucified and beheaded in Armenia. Gory stuff, isn't it? And we have James, the son of Alphaeus, and he's persistently confused with James, the brother of Jesus, but they're different individuals. He ministered in Syria, and we don't really know much about his death. And then we have Thaddeus, who's often confused with Jude, the brother of Jesus, and he ministered in Edessa, and his death is unknown. Matthew, you might be aware of his legend. He was killed by a spear in Egypt. Simon the Zealot was also in Egypt, and his death is unknown. And then we have Matthias, who replaced Judas. And we have a letter during that time period that simply said, Matthias preached the gospel to barbarians and meat eaters in the interior of Ethiopia. Well, that was interesting that meat eaters were compared to barbarians. All right, so he died in a town called Sebastopolis, and was buried there near the Temple of the Sun. And then
did you say Ethiopia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. And then we have Thomas, who was imprisoned in India, and he was slain by a dart. And then Judas Iscariot, who, of course, hanged himself after betraying Jesus. All right, any questions on these guys? So we'll move on to other church leaders, and the information here is even less reliable. A lot of this stuff is very, very sketchy, so we'll just take it with a grain of salt. But our interest here is how these stories have been passed down through the generations, and it's just kind of interesting. So Mark supposedly was burned at a stake in Egypt. Luke died at age of 84 in Boeotia, which is inside Greece. James, the brother of the Lord, was stoned. Am I going too fast? Taking notes. Sorry. Mark died at a stake and burned at the stake in Egypt. Luke died naturally in. You want the spelling of it? Boeotia. Then James, the brother of the Lord, was stoned. Paul was supposedly beheaded as a Roman citizen in Rome during the reign of Nero. And then Barnabas, hostile Jews found him in Syria where he was preaching the gospel in a synagogue, dragged him out, tortured him, and stoned him to death. And then Timothy, in the year 97... he was like a bishop at the time, 80 years old. He tried to halt the procession of a parade that was honoring the goddess Diana. And the angry pagans, he tried to do that by preaching the gospel, proclaiming that she was a false idol. And the angry pagans beat him up, dragged him through the streets, and stoned him to death. So I don't know. I mean, this is what they say. We don't have any actual history of this stuff. And then Jude was martyred in Syria. And in various, this is interesting, in various church artwork through the generations, he is depicted as holding an axe, which symbolizes the way in which he was killed. So, just a few of many like that. Okay, Let's move on now to something more substantial, the Apostolic Fathers. Oops. Okay, and we're good. All right. So when we say Apostolic Fathers, we've got two uses for that term. It could refer to the actual church leaders who sat at the feet of the apostles who belonged to that generation that followed them. It could also refer to their writings, like the earliest documents immediately following the New Testament era. And if you will remember from last week, there's kind of a word that scholars will use to refer to those writings, and we refer to it as the patristics. Remember that? It's just a word that means it's connected to the word father somehow. And so, example, you might actually read in a commentary or something like, we learned from the patristics that the two greatest threats to the early church was heresies and persecution, something like that. So if you see the word patristics, and you'll know, okay, it's referring to those guys who were the disciples of the apostles. So the post-apostolic period, it runs more or less from the end of the first century to about halfway through the second century. And so these writings are going to provide significant insights into the life of the early church during a critical stage of its history. So problems would come up because the apostles now have died. There's nobody like to stand up and speak on behalf of the church to address these problems. We've got problems of heresy. We've got problems of what do we do in this persecution. And we've got schisms, people who are threatening to divide the church over this or that. And these writings give us a kind of a glimpse into the nature of these different challenges that the church faced and how they were handled, that sort of thing. So we have various authors of these documents. They're not especially skilled as writers. They're kind of hard to read at times. They're clumsily written. And they're not always precise theologically. We would expect that to be the case, but they're not. And they use, many of them use questionable methods of hermeneutics. some have no author ascribed to them at all, like the one called the Didache, which is probably the one with the most popular among them and the one that we consider having a lot of weight. But there's no author ascribed to it. So they are readily available. These writings are readily available today in books like this. We'd have something just called the Apostolic Fathers, where they've translated it into modern language. And then another one, a different publisher, which includes some things that the paperback doesn't. And then we have this one, which goes just says early Christian fathers, but includes more than just the writings of the Apostolic Fathers. So it's kind of good to read from different versions, because they have different translations and the author will make different comments about that sort of thing. All right, so let's, this whole thing is kind of like a worthy of a whole nother series in itself, but today we're just going to do a quick survey of it, just a real quick survey. So let's start with First Clement, and First Clement would be named after a guy named, see how easy this is? All right. So he is of Rome, and he's writing to the Church of Corinth. Clement was the bishop of Rome, and he primarily addresses in this letter a revolt against the elders of the church by some of the younger members of the church. So he's calling for peace and telling those younger guys to settle down and to submit to the leadership of that church in Rome. All right, so Second Clement. We don't know whether this was written by Clement or not. It's actually a sermon. It was composed sometime between 100 and 140. It's the first sermon that we actually have outside what we find in Scripture. The reason it's called Second Clement is because this letter was found with First Clement. So it was just assumed that Clement wrote it. But it is devoted to practical matters. It's not all that theological. It emphasizes that repentance must consist of action. And then we have the seven letters of Ignatius of Antioch. And Ignatius was the bishop of Antioch. He was a disciple of the Apostle John. And he had been condemned to death. He was sent to Rome, where it appears that his martyrdom was to play a big part in a celebration for a recent military victory, and that he was going to be sacrificed, in essence, to thank the gods for the victory and to amuse the people, and the martyrdom was going to be by that of throwing him to wild animals in the Colosseum. So these seven letters were written on his way there. He's under armed guard taken to Rome. And each letter is pretty similar. I have those names listed there. And they emphasize the unity of the church. Ignatius emphasizes the role of the bishop, the importance of him and how he needs to be submitted to, the importance of the Lord's Supper, and that union with Christ comes down to practical matters of regular worship and faithfulness in one's daily life, those sorts of things. And in some of them, he warns against specific groups. He warns against the Judaizers and the Docetists, and we'll talk about the Docetists here in a little bit. And he responds to a plan that he's overheard about a rescue and that some of his followers or friends, Christians who are sympathetic, want to intervene and rescue him. And he learns about them, begs them not to intervene, and he writes this: "Now I begin to be a disciple. Let fire and cross, flocks of beasts, broken bones, dismemberment come upon me so long as I attain to Jesus Christ." So he had a desire to glorify the Lord through his death. And a tradition arose that he was one of the children. Again, I don't know how you would ever connect any of this, but a tradition arose that he was one of the children whom Jesus took into his arms and blessed, that we read about in the apostles. So it'd be kind of neat to think that could be the case. Those children grew up to be real people somewhere. I guess they were real people when they were children too. All right, Polycarp of Smyrna. Polycarp was a staunch defender of orthodoxy in the middle of the second century. He also was a disciple of the Apostle John. He devoted much of his energy to combating such heresies as Marcionism and were those heretics of Marcion and Valentinus, which we'll talk about probably next week. And though Ignatius hints that Polycarp had written several letters, only one has survived, the one that was written to the church at Philippi. And he exhorts them to remain faithful to the truth and to not drift from orthodoxy to heresy. It's not necessarily a creative letter. He basically quotes numerous passages from the Gospels, and he quotes from the book of Acts and the letters of Paul. But he does the job. And what this does is, of course, tell us that the early church fathers had a high regard for these documents, the New Testament documents, and they quoted from them as though they had the authority of Scripture. They regarded them as Scripture. So there's an apologetic advantage there for us. All right, we have the martyrdom of Polycarp. The author here is unknown, but he is an eyewitness to the events. He witnesses Polycarp's arrest, trial, and death. It's the earliest account of a Christian martyr outside the New Testament. And Polycarp is burned alive for refusing to worship the emperor, burning incense unto him. All right, then we have the Shepherd of Hermas, written sometime between 100 and 150, and it consists of visions and commands and parables centering on the themes of God's mercy and living for God. We don't know who Hermas was. The theology in the book is not very precise and even kind of confusing at times. He seems to kind of refer to the Son and the Holy Spirit in the same way as though they're the same person, so it's kind of hard to follow. The main value of the book is found in its ethical instruction, but to get that you have to wade through lots of parables and visions and symbolism, so it's just kind of a bizarre read. The letter of Barnabas has no name attached to it, but it's traditionally been attributed to Barnabas. And this could possibly be the Barnabas referred to in the book of Acts who accompanied Paul, but we can't say for sure. There are basically two parts to this letter. There's a long section devoted to a number of teachings based on allegorical interpretations of the Old Testament. And then the second part contrasts the way of darkness and the way of light, which was a familiar method back then. Okay, am I going too fast?
Always.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Okay, then we have the exposition of the sayings of the Lord by Papias, and all we have here are just fragments. He also was a disciple of the Apostle John, and it's an important early source on the origin of the Gospels because he refers to the authors of these Gospels and makes that connection. And then we have the letter to Diognetus. And again, the author is unknown. He claims to be a student of the apostles in this letter. It is kind of like the first evangelism track. He defends the faith against idols and superstition, and he explains why Jesus came. And then finally, we have the Didache, which is the teaching of the 12 apostles. And didache just simply means teaching. So everyone agrees that the apostles didn't write it, but that was kind of like their early understanding, but we've come to realize that that's not the case. But the early church did believe that it embodied their teachings. And this book was widely known in the early centuries, highly regarded by church leaders. And a number of scholars today believe that the author borrowed his material from other Christian documents of that time period. So it consists of two parts. The first six chapters contrast the way of life and the way of death. And it provides instruction for new believers and giving them basic moral guidance. And the remaining part of the book addresses a variety of themes dealing with food, baptism, prayer, fasting, Lord's Supper, the need for government in the church, warning to be on the lookout for deceivers, and those who would come through as itinerant preachers wanting money and that kind of thing. And then also this being prepared for the Lord. And it also condemns abortion. So you see it often referred to in pro-life literature. And for a while in certain regions, the Didache was part of the collection of New Testament documents that were being circulated among the churches. So there, at least in some places, it was given that kind of weight and authority, but eventually it failed to meet the standard because of the unknown authorship behind it. All right, I went through that pretty quick because I'm eager to get into early Christian Gnosticism, which is the next item. But any questions about what we've covered so far? All right, ready for this? All right, this is fun stuff. Early, we have, excuse me. We have early Gnosticism taking place in the first century, and then in the second century, it develops into a whole system under a guy named Valentinus, which we'll talk more about in the weeks to come. So in Gnosticism, we are casting Platonism into a religious framework. So it's a smorgasbord of ideas and thoughts. Excuse me. So we have to start with a quick review of Platonism. First the computer, now my throat. I'm still getting pop-ups. Google password required. Oh my gosh. I do not. Okay, we're back there. All right, good. All right. So, quick review of Platonism. So in Platonism, we have, there's a lot to it, but for our purposes here, what we're focusing on is this, there's this dualistic view of the universe. We have two worlds, two different spheres of reality. We have the unseen and the seen. We have the spiritual, the physical. We have the perfect and the corrupt. We have the real and the shadow, okay? That kind of dualism. So in the unseen world, this is where we find like things like ideas and concepts, the true reality, the uncorrupted. And in the physical world, that's the shadows of the unseen, the imperfect copies. Unseen world, we have the moral virtues, all that is good. Physical world is secondary, it's inferior, it's actually undesirable. That's where we find pain, suffering, chaos, and disorder. So the soul is imprisoned in the human body, in the physical world, and death releases it to the perfect, to the unseen. So Platonism emphasizes this, again, this dualism of worlds. One is good and desirable, and the other is corrupt and undesirable. So you could see how untrained Christians could, you know, kind of anchor into that, because Christianity talks about the spiritual world and the physical world. And there is this temptation then to merge, harmonize those ideas of Platonism into Christianity. Like there's got to be, you know, it's all going to be talking about the same thing at some point. So let's see if we can syncretize this. And the problem comes up is that they can't be syncretized because there's just too many great differences at the core. Because what does the Bible say about creation itself? That is good, okay? Platonism would not teach that. The incarnation tells us that creation is good. because it's just unthinkable that somebody from the unseen would come and touch and become part of the physical world. And the resurrection is bizarre as well, because why would you want to be resurrected? Why, if you're dead and not released from this prison, come back into it? That doesn't make any sense. So there's just all sorts of these conflicts. So Platonism is not a religion. We have to remember that. It's just a way of understanding the world, a way of processing a philosophical view. But Gnosticism is religious. And so that's what we want to talk about. So we begin with Platonism, which is the driving philosophy here. And then to get to Gnosticism, we have to add... You've got to be kidding me. Just want to start screaming? Do I scream now? Why don't everybody leave the room and let me scream and then you come back in?
Interesting side note on Matthias, the apostle ministering in Ethiopia. It is believed that the meat eaters referenced in historical accounts were actually cannibals.
I wondered about that.
He was ministering to a city known for cannibalism.
That would make a lot more sense. Okay. So to get to Gnosticism, we begin with Platonism. Then we add elements of either Jewish or Eastern mysticism, which is some of that, which is affecting my computer. There we go. Then we add to that elements of Christianity, and the element here would be primarily as Christ as the light of the world, that idea. And then we end up with Gnosticism. So Platonism is the driving force, but we add these other elements to it. So Gnosticism takes Plato's concepts of dualism, the spirit world, physical world, and this idea of matter being evil, and attempts to explain how the physical world came into being, where people came from, why good is mixed up with evil, where good and evil come from, and why some people are more spiritual than others. See, these are all religious questions. Platonism's not interested in that, but, you know, from a religious viewpoint, you're going to be interested in these things, and even wants to try to figure out, you know, address this idea of redemption and salvation, how to be rescued from darkness. And so Gnosticism comes from the word knowledge. All right. So those who belong to the kingdom of God have special insights that others do not have, and they are the enlightened ones. So there's many different streams and groups. There are a lot of differences among them. It's kind of like, a smorgasbord, but there are some things that are in common. And this would include, like, God cannot touch physical matter or be associated with it in any way. He's totally other. He's not going to be involved in this creation. Creation is the result of a mistake, not purpose, not part of a divine plan. There is no incarnation. Some groups denied Christ's divinity, denied that the Word was made flesh. Other groups denied Christ's physical body. We'll talk about that here in a minute. And that there is no resurrection, because the goal is escaping this current life. So who is Jesus in Gnosticism? Well, the details of that are going to depend on the particular stream or group, but all Gnostics have this in common about Jesus. He is a messenger sent from the spirit world to enlighten those who are imprisoned in this world, and the salvation he offers is through revelation, not atonement. He is the revealer of spiritual mysteries. He is the true light who gives us light. Okay, so some of this stuff sounds a little New Agey because it's very similar. So the mysticism part of Gnosticism is this idea that we can become one with God through things like meditation or rituals. And this experience then, this personal knowledge of God, enables the person to become spiritually aware, and he enters into a higher level of being, a higher level of reality, a higher level of spirituality. And each stream or group, you know, has their own way of attaining the special knowledge. But generally, it involves either practices of meditation or certain ceremonial rituals or an ascetic lifestyle. What does ascetic mean again? Denial of of natural appetites, a rigorous, highly disciplined lifestyle, or it could be a combination of any of those. All right, so to run through it again, we start with Platonism. This world and physical matter is inferior, corrupt, undesirable. It's like a prison. Death releases us from it. We add mysticism. We can, in our souls, which belong to the world above, become one with God, and this gives us insight into spiritual realities, special knowledge. And we add Christianity. Jesus is the enlightener, the one who shows us the way into this deeper spiritual realm and its mysteries. So a lot of emphasis on light. All right. Gnosticism. Got that? Followed it? Okay.
Can you say, God cannot touch physical matter. Creation is a mistake. Was the next one no indwelling before no resurrection?
No incarnation. Thank you. Yeah, no incarnation. No true incarnation. We could have an illusion of an incarnation.
Okay.
And no resurrection. Okay, so we have two early examples of Gnosticism in the first century, and this shows us how Greek thought was merged into Christianity and the heresies that resulted. And this would be the Ebionites and the Docetists, and both have serious issues with the incarnation because a totally holy God, infinite spirit, would not touch physical matter, much less become a physical being himself. And both of them end up denying the incarnation, turning it into an illusion of some sort. And either there was no human Jesus at all, only something that looked like it was human, or God the Son was simply using a human Jesus as a vehicle but was not in real union with him. And so you're forced into one of two options here, either deny Christ's true humanity or deny his true divinity. So both of these start at pretty much at the same time in the late first century, and they are the two of the earliest Christological heresies that we have of the church. However, they actually failed to attract that many followers, so they never really proved to be that great of a threat. But we're interested because it does show how Greek thought did find its way, and Eastern and Jewish mysticism found its way into Christianity at points. So we'll start with the Ebionites. 1, 2, 3. Ah, it worked. All right, there we go. So this is a Jewish sect. These are Jewish Christians, quote-unquote Christians, that recognized Jesus as the Messiah. They were vegetarians. This is, of course, the first sign of trouble whenever anybody says they're vegetarians. They saw poverty as holy. They were big into ceremonial washings. They were just obsessed with bathing rituals. They rejected Christ's virgin birth, teaching that Jesus was just a normal guy, the natural son of Joseph and Mary, and that he was not God in the flesh. However, he was a special man who had been chosen by God to become a vehicle, temporarily, to manifest the eternal Christ. So the eternal Christ here in this case would be like the eternal Word. Christ the Spirit comes and inhabits the human being Jesus. And when do you think that might have occurred? At the moment of Jesus' baptism. Yes. All right. Very good. And then departs. When do you think the eternal Word, the Christ the Spirit, departed the man Jesus?
Crucifixion.
All right. Notice these words here in Luke. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. When he said this, he breathed his last. So the Ebionites interpret that as though Jesus died after the eternal Logos, the eternal Christ, left them. Okay, so interesting. All right, because the human body is made of matter, and because matter is the source of evil and disorder, again, Platonism, the best we could do, according to the Ebionites, is to say that Jesus inhabited the soul of man known as Jesus. It's similar to how we might visualize demon possession in a way, because it controls the person. So if you adopt Gnosticism, this is one option. You deny the divinity of Jesus. All right? Any questions on Ebionism? They're an actual group. They don't last real long, I don't believe, but they did have... They were a thing in the first century. All right, so if you don't go that route, you're left with this other choice, and that's, you can either pronounce it Docetism or Docetism. I go back and forth. I'm inconsistent with it, but I've heard it pronounced both ways. And that's to go in the opposite direction and deny his humanity. So let's move on to them. And their twist was this. It's pretty easy to follow. Jesus is the Christ. There's not two separate entities here. He is the Christ, but he only appeared to be a man. And that is why they are called Docetists, because the word Docetus simply means to appear, to seem. And Jesus was a pure spiritual deity. He was sent from above to enlighten mankind with deep spiritual mysteries, but he only appeared to be in the flesh. He only appeared to suffer. He only appeared to die on the cross. And, you know, the saying, when he walked on the sand, there were no footprints left because he was a spiritual phantom entity sort of thing. He wasn't really physical, right? Interesting. So unlike the Ebionites, who were an actual religious sect, the Docetists were not really organized into any one particular group. This was more like a popular movement that just infiltrated many of the early churches, and it did it through the clergy, and therefore is technically the first heresy that is clearly lodged within Christianity, because we'd have these Catholic Orthodox churches, and then we have clergy that get polluted with this kind of thinking, and then they'd start spreading it in their own congregations. So early did Docetism surface that one church father wrote, quote, "While the apostles were still surviving, while Christ's blood was still fresh in Judea, the Lord's body was asserted to be but a phantom." So this is very early, we see. And I read this somewhere, and I can't remember where I wrote it. I looked this week for it and could not find it. But I'm going to pass it on as though it is true or something to consider. The whole business of making the sign of the cross in the early church was used as a way to filter out who was going to be allowed into the assembly, because Docetists would find their way into the assemblies, and the Docetists would not make the sign of the cross because they denied that Jesus actually died. It was just an illusion. So I don't know if that's how that practice actually got started. I couldn't find any information on that, but supposedly it at least was used in that way, if it didn't start that way. So problem with Platonism and Gnosticism is that Ebionites denied Christ's true divinity, Jesus' true divinity, where the Docetists denied his true humanity. All right, any questions on any of that? I thought that stuff was really interesting. Anybody?
Those could be sections in and of themselves, really.
What's that?
I said those could be sections in and of themselves,
yeah.
Really, to unpack.
Yeah, the thinking is interesting to see how, I mean, this is going to be the natural conclusion you're going to come if you're going to embrace these ideas.
Even they would have to basically deny that, you know, creation was good.
Yeah.
Right from the get-go, and basically deny the first section of Genesis.
Yeah, I don't know how they would, I don't know what they did with the Old Testament, but I would assume that they would probably take a very allegorical approach to everything. Okay. I think I'm done with this. Good. For now. Get that fixed. I never have these problems except on Sunday morning. It's either up there or now it's here. It's the... All right. Ready for Roman persecution? Still got energy for this?
Are we ready to hear about it?
Yeah. No, we're ready to experience it. Isn't Russia the new... I mean, they both start with the word, with the letter R, so there's got to be the resurrection. R, the resurrection of Russia is... Or the resurrection of Rome is Russia, the coming down from the north.
That's right.
I think they're more north of us than on the what do you call it, the long latitude?
Longitude?
Latitude? It's all Revelation. It's all there. Roman persecution. Okay, so this is a major factor in shaping the early church, and we're going to start by looking at the why. And, you know, what was it about, you know, the Roman Empire that caused its emperors to lash out against Christians? Why were they so contentious about this? So we need to kind of start with Caesar Augustus. We talked about him last week, if you will remember. He was like the first and the greatest of the emperors. He was like the salvation of Rome. He's the one that brought Pax Romana, law and order, Roman peace, and military conquest, and political and economic stability, and safe and easy travel, and all this. And so the citizens, they honored him greatly for his achievements. They deeply respected him and his throne. They feared his power. And this fear and admiration, it carried on in the emperors that followed him and eventually became veneration. And the Romans gradually began to see their emperor as the embodiment of the state. It's kind of like an icon, the symbol of the empire itself, and attributed to him this sort of sense of deity early on, and even began to offer up sacrifices to him in their temples of worship. And this worship became a powerful force in support of the majesty and the prestige and the authority of his throne and of the great and powerful Roman nation. And it was a unifying force. And the best way to think of this today is just think patriotism. This is what this was. Because the emperor was the embodiment of the state, to burn incense unto him was to give your allegiance to the empire itself. Similar to us singing the national anthem or pledging allegiance to the flag. And Christians who refused, of course, were booed by their neighbors and their people in their community in the same way that probably like football players today who, during the national anthem, we see them on TV taking a knee, and they just find that to be very disturbing. Well, that's the same kind of sentiment that was expressed toward the Christians when they wouldn't burn incense to the emperor. So keep in mind at this time that the people did not really object to venerating the emperor in this way, worshiping him, because all religions except Judaism were polytheistic. And again, what does polytheistic mean? Yeah, worship of many gods. So these traditional polytheistic, you just, along with worshiping all these other gods, you just add the emperor. It's no big deal. What's one more? And these traditional polytheistic religions that accepted the worship of the emperor were officially declared religio licita, which means lawful religion. And any religion, however, that did not permit the worship of the emperor was declared religio illicita, unlawful religion. Am I pronouncing the Latin right? I thought you teach Latin.
You didn't write the word down. Yeah, no, they would have pronounced it differently than... ecclesiastical Latin anyway.
So. Okay, all right.
Whatever you say is probably right.
Well, this is how it works phonetically. So the point is, you know, either your religion was either lawful because it included the worship of the emperor, or it was not lawful because it did not include the worship of the emperor. So only one group of the empire were qualified for an exemption from this, at least initially, and that would be the Jews. So the reason... several. It's just extremely difficult to enforce. The population of the empire included millions of Jews, and they were spread out all over the empire. They were not limited to just one country or region, and logistically it would have been difficult to enforce this. Jews were ardent monotheists, one god, and to force them into worshiping another deity would be no small feat. It is too messy, and as we learned from last week, that whenever other political leaders would try to do that, it just got into big bloody revolts and all sorts of things. And so Rome learned from history. They weren't going to repeat those mistakes. Rome did not want to risk the unity of the empire with an unnecessary showdown over this particular issue, so they provided that exemption. And also the Jews as a whole, when they were prosperous, they were well organized, they were influential. Again, thinking outside, you know, the whole Roman Empire here, or within the whole Roman Empire. And you know, it's just too much at stake to force this. So this only applied to the Jews. However, initially, Christians enjoyed that same exemption and that the Jews enjoyed. Again, and why would this be? Why did Christians enjoy it initially? Because Christians were thought to be just part of the Jews, okay? And throughout the book of Acts, we see this. Whenever, you know, Christians are brought before the Roman governors, you know, not the Sanhedrin, but Roman governors, you know, the judges would be just exasperated with the whole thing and say, look, you guys have your own courts, your own Jewish courts. Take up the matter there. Don't bother us with it. Get out of here. But eventually, the Romans caught on that Christianity was not merely a sect within Judaism, but distinct, and thus the toleration that was extended to the Jews did not failed to continue on with them. And some of this had to do with the Jews being with the Jews expelling Christians from the synagogues. So Christians, you know, might have been ardent worshipers of only one God like the Jews, but they were not powerful or influential or numerous like the Jews, so they did not enjoy this exemption. Plus, the Jews eventually themselves fell out of favor with Rome and also became a target, though it doesn't seem that the persecution against the Jews rose to the same levels it did toward the Christians. All right, so I think we've got time here to finish this up with the five major reasons Christians were persecuted by the Romans. The first and primary reason was this, of course, refusal to permit emperor worship by its members. Romans saw this as an act of patriotism. Christians saw it as idolatry. The Romans, however, took this refusal as an act of treason. It is the emperor's, what they called, guardian spirit, his genius that blesses the empire with prosperity in times of peace, victory in times of war, justice of law, progress in the arts, fruitfulness of the field, fertility of the herd, and so on. And to refuse worship of the emperor was to invite the wrath and vengeance of the gods. Secondly, along with the charge of the hate of the empire, they're also accused of hating mankind. And this was supported by a whole list of specific charges, like many refused service in the army or government because they tended to be more pacifist, not seeing that a lot of these wars that Romans were involved in were justified. Many Christians would not attend the public performances at the stadium, the gladiator games, all that blood and barbaric actions and lions and all that stuff, and even events that were not necessarily objectionable, like theater and sports and so on, were avoided by Christians because, want to take a guess why Christians didn't go to those things? Because they would often, or if not always, be opened up with an invocation to a Roman deity. And Christians just felt like they could participate and share in that. Many refused to send their kids to local schools. They were considered to be like separatists, and Christians were not very pluralistic, of course, taught that Christianity was the only true religion and that the Lord was the only true God. All right, so they were easy to be persecuted by the Romans because they didn't enjoy a lot of support from their communities. Number three, there were all kinds of rumors that flourished about the alleged immoral practices of their religious assemblies. You can probably speculate this. Because the communion service was a private ceremony, just about anything that anybody wanted to claim was going on was believed. So there were accusations of cannibalism. This because, you eat the flesh and drink the blood. And then Sunday gatherings, the rumors were that these were wild sex orgies because of the kiss of peace and loving each other and that sort of thing. And then number four, Rome was suspicious. They were just threatened by anything, any groups that met regularly and groups that grew rapidly, like the Christians were. They appeared to be well organized to the Romans. In reality, they were not that well organized, but they appeared to be. And that they obeyed church leaders. Remember this whole thing about obeying the bishop? They really did obey the bishop of their region. And Rome was threatened by all of this. And the fear of a revolt caused the empire to distrust parties and unions and meetings of any kind among the common people. And then number five, this is kind of interesting. They were actually accused of being atheists. So why were Christians being accused of being atheists?
They denied the other gods?
No. It's a good guess. Because the god they worshipped could not be seen. Where at least you have images of the other pagan deities, and the emperor, you could see him and that sort of thing. So they were accused of being atheists because they were worshiping nothing and in the eyes of the community and the Romans themselves. But again, the main reason is this stubbornness that they had. And it was at the heart of the arrest, the trials, and the convictions, and therefore the actual charge that Christians were convicted of was contempt of court, the same kind of charge we have today. And we'll talk more about that next week, where we'll look at persecution under specific emperors. But this persecution spanned from across a 250-year period, from around 60 AD to 312 when Constantine makes Christianity legal. And it goes through various cycles, months, years. It's sometimes it's you know, it relaxes, sometimes it heats up, sometimes it's just in specific areas, sometimes it's across the whole empire, sometimes it's light, and the penalty is pretty, you know, it might consist of some jail time or forfeiting of property. Other times it's very severe, like torture and even death. And even though there was, even when during these times that there was not a direct attack from Rome, Christians still suffered in other ways, especially discrimination from their communities. So Christians, like we said last week, they were both well loved and admired, and they were also hated and despised. It's you know, it's one or the other. They were the salt of the earth. People reacted very distinctly toward them. All right. So next week we'll look at the specific periods of persecution. We'll look at how the Christians appealed to Roman authorities for leniency. Letters were written to the empire by Christian leaders and say, hey, you shouldn't persecute us because, and they list out the reasons. And then we'll have time to look at second century heresies. Today we looked at first century. Well, we're going to take Gnosticism and see how it developed in the second century that became quite troublesome. And then we've got a kind of like a bothersome, I don't know, I'd call it a heretical group, but an aberrant group that just proved to be real bothersome to the church. And that'll be interesting to talk about them as well. All right, so here we are, right on time. Thank you for your attendance and coming back. And get like a, what is it? They're not donuts. What do you call them? Pastries? Yeah.